I started writing actually very young. I started writing when this thing happened to my eyes. When I was about 16 at school, I had this violent attack of keratitis, which I had to leave school because I became practically blind, and I had to learn Braille and to continue my education with tutors. And during that time, I learned to use a typewriter. It was the only way I could write. And then I started to write. I actually wrote a whole novel at that period, which I never subsequently read. And this has disappeared. I rather regret that it has disappeared, because I would be interested to know what it was like now. It was a sort of romantic... it wasn't very romantic. It was a sort of rather bitter novel about a young man's relationship with two different types of women, as I remember it. I discovered that I liked writing, that I had a certain gift for it. And I had, of course, before I went blind, intended to become a doctor. I presume if I had gone on with that, I would have gone into medical research, because I don't think I would have been a very good practicing doctor, but I might have been a fairly good medical researcher.
But why wouldn't you have been any good at medical practice?
I would have been good enough in sort of personal relationships, which I think are tremendously important with in a good doctor. I mean, I was diffident and shy and awkward then. I think I've slightly improved with age. But I don't know that I would have been very good. But I think I would always been very interested in the research part of the thing. But anyhow, I couldn't go on with that kind of scientific career, because I couldn't use a microscope or do any of the necessary work in the laboratory. So that this determined my choice of a career, but I had to go into something else. And then I discovered that I could write, and that I did like writing. And from that time on, I always wrote a good deal. I wrote when I was an undergraduate. I wrote a lot of verse in those days, and then I also wrote a certain amount of prose. And I did publish my first prose book about 1920, I think, the first book of stories that I wrote.
How did you come to publish? Did you already know publishers, or did you write to them?
Well, I'd published a certain amount of verse in periodicals. I'd published two little volumes of verse with Blackwell at Oxford, and a certain amount had been published, as I say, in papers like The Nation and in art journals of different kinds. And I'd written a certain number of essays and stories which had been published. And I sent my first book of stories to Chatto and Windus, where Frank Swinnerton read them and set his seal of approval upon them. And I've been with Chatto's ever since. I've always enjoyed it. I've always... It's never come very easily. I mean, all my thoughts, in a sense, are second thoughts. I tend to write everything over again. But I like it. It's laborious, but it's work which I find very rewarding and extraordinarily interesting. I mean, this seeking the right way of saying something. And I must say, I was very interested not long ago in looking over an old volume of essays which I'd written while at Oxford for my tutor. I took English literature at Oxford, and these were essays on all sorts of literary subjects, I mean, from Chaucer down to the present day. And I was interested and surprised to find that I was writing quite well at that time. I mean, that I had a certain feeling for style, and that there was even a certain elegance in what I was doing, even at the age of 20, that I had obviously some kind of natural gift for writing. Although, as I say, it's always been a considerable work for me. I mean, it's this I never get the results I want, except as a result of careful correction and going over and rewriting. I don't work out anything in great detail. I mean, I sort of start a thing and then it becomes clear that this has to be done, and I reach a point out in front, and therefore this means something that the back has to be changed, and it develops in this way. I don't work out a thing in any elaboration in advance.
Would you say that any one of your novels has been more real to you than another?
In some ways, the Time Must Have a Stop was the one I enjoyed most of all doing.
In your early years, was your defect of eyesight a great handicap?
Well, every handicap, of course, is a challenge. I mean, one is limited naturally in what one can do. I was strictly limited in all kinds of otherwise normal activities. I mean, many things that I liked doing, like mountain climbing and so on, became very difficult or impossible for me. I couldn't practice any kind of sport requiring hitting a ball, so I couldn't see the balls. And on the other hand, the fact that there is this kind of challenge, if the handicap isn't too great, the challenge can often stimulate one to do things which I think in other circumstances one wouldn't do. I mean, it's in a sense a little bit like the problem of the sculptor. The sculptor wrestling with extremely hard and intransigent stone is forced to do things which the sculptor who works only in clay doesn't have to do. I mean, it's in a sense too easy. So that unless the handicap is too great and is overwhelming, it does act as a kind of stimulus and drives one on to do things. I did read a great deal, and I'm extremely astonished at how much I was able to read, because at the beginning, for about 2 years after this thing came upon me when I was 16, I couldn't read at all. As I say, I had to learn Braille, and I had to have tutors who read to me, and then, little by little, I was able to read with it. But I did all my reading while I was at Oxford with a powerful magnifying glass, which I must say I'm amazed that I got through as much as I did. And it was obviously always rather tiring, this whole process, but I managed to do it. And I suppose I've always had a passion for knowledge and a certain gift for coordinating facts. I mean, this is what interests me in writing, in expression, in thought, is the attempt to coordinate different fields, the attempt to say many things at the same time, the attempt to bring together into a single coherent and meaningful whole a great many apparently disparate events and data. This has been the ideal of writing that I've always had, and I think I have a certain gift for it. And this is what interests me. And sometimes I go too far, I get carried away and try to put in too much, and I require then to go back and simplify and cut things out. But I really don't like the very bare, bald, classical style, because it's much, to my mind, hopelessly oversimplified and therefore not true. I mean, life in its reality is incredibly complex and very, very subtle, and therefore I would think that any form of art which is as simplified, say, as the French tragedy of the 17th century, is intrinsically an inferior art. I mean, maybe very, very elegant and beautiful. But if you can do it, impose order upon a much more complex mass of material, as Shakespeare was able to do, this seems to me intrinsically a superior form of art. And I would say this is true of any kind of art. I mean, isn't this the distinction in the pictorial arts between what is technically known as fine art and the crafts? The crafts are extremely simple forms. I mean, the form of pottery is exceedingly simple, and it can be incredibly beautiful. But at the same time, is it as high a form of art as a great composition, where enormous numbers of elements, both formal and literary in the widest sense, and emotional, are brought together and harmonized in a great composition? I would feel unquestionably that the great composition which brings together and harmonizes many elements is intrinsically a higher form of art than the simple, elegant, so-called classical form. After all, life is immensely complex. Why pretend that it isn't? I mean, and why not attempt, with a sufficient background of knowledge and information, to make some kind of synthesis, some kind of meaningful pattern of a large extent of information? I find this kind of new criticism unspeakably boring. I mean, it seems to me so barren, and it's this hideous jargon they've invented. I don't know what it's all about. It just bores me absolutely stiff, this whole thing. It seems to me so trivial in many respects. Although I think probably some of this work has to be done, this kind of very elaborate and meticulous linguistic work is probably useful. But to regard it as the sort of be-all and end-all of criticism seems to me absolutely absurd.
What were the main conscious influences on your development? If you were asked, who would you say influenced you most in your youth?
After I went blind, I mean, I had a succession of tutors, one of whom was President Sir George Clarke, who was is he called the president or the principal of Oriel? Was he Oriel? I think so. The 17th century historian. He was very remarkable. He was a contemporary of my second brother, who subsequently died at Oxford, and he'd just sort of come down from Oxford, and he tutored me, and I certainly got a great deal out of him. He was extremely well-read and highly civilized young man. And then, up at Oxford, I happened to have a very good tutor in English literature, who was unfortunately killed in the war, Tiddy. Then after that, I had these extraordinary fortune to meet a great many of the ablest people of my time. I mean, all the Bloomsbury people like Maynard Keynes and Clive Bell and Vanessa and Virginia Woolf, Russell I met then, and D.H. Lawrence. And this was a sort of liberal education to me, and Roger Fry was whom was very kind to me, and from whom I certainly learned a great deal about art, for example. Roger Fry, I think, remains a very good art critic. I mean, he had extraordinary sensibility and immense knowledge and enthusiasm, and was a good, genuinely good man, as well as being immensely charming and interesting. And then Clive Bell, he was always extremely stimulating, very kind to me. I mean, from them I learned a great deal about art, which I really didn't know anything about at all before. I mean, they sort of introduced me to modern art, to post-impressionism and cubism and so on. Keynes I knew less well, but I mean, he was always fascinating. He had this immense range of knowledge and would come out with these curious or rather elliptical remarks about things. He was always very, very fascinating character. All this was an immensely educative thing, and this was all at the house of Lady Ottoline Murrell, where I lived there for a year or so during the First World War.
Are there, in your opinion, any writers who will survive and will be read?
Actually, I think the most exciting people that I read as an undergraduate and just afterwards were French writers. I got sort of my introduction to French literature at that time. I mean, I read Proust when he first came out in 1914, Du Côté de Chez Swann. Then I read the French poets then. Mallarmé made an immense impression upon me, and still does. I'm still very fond of him. And Rimbaud made an immense impression on me then. No one author has had very great influence over me. I mean, I get things out of all reasonably good authors, and even out of some bad authors that I read. I used to get a lot out of Proust. I reread some of it the other day and was rather disappointed. I don't know why. I mean, it didn't seem to me that the... I mean, I read the last volume, the Temps Retrouvé. It seemed to me curiously remote and unbelievable and unreal. And even the first volume, which I read part of the other day, passages which I thought were very beautiful in the early days, I didn't get very much out of. I don't know why. It's very strange, because it moved me immensely when it first appeared. I must read it again and have another look at it. Well, I think some of Hemingway's stories are very remarkable, short stories. And I haven't read the more recent books, which I understand are not particularly good. Nor have I read the more recent Faulkner's. But I liked some of the early books, Soldier's Pay, Inviting August, and Sanctuary. But I confess I haven't read anything recently. Joyce, it seemed to me, seemed to think that words were omnipotent. I mean, they are not omnipotent. He was a very strange man. I used to see him sometimes in Paris. This extraordinary, what may be called his magic view of words. I mean, it's sort of, I should never forget sitting next to him once at dinner and mentioning to him, which I thought would have given him pleasure, and it did, that I'd just been rereading the Odyssey. And his immediate response was, he said, "Now, do you realize what the derivation of Odysseus, the name Odysseus, is?" I said, "No, I don't." And he said, "Well, it really comes from the two words Udais, meaning nobody, and Zeus, meaning God. And that Odysseus is really a symbol of creation of man out of nothing." Well, I mean, this is exactly the sort of etymology which would have been made by Albertus Magnus in the 13th century. I mean, it had absolutely no relation, of course, to anything which we would regard as realistic etymology. But this completely satisfied Joyce's mind, and this curious sort of magic approach to words as having some sort of intrinsic value apart from their references was a very characteristic thing in him. Ulysses is obviously a very extraordinary book. I mean, I don't exactly know why he wrote it, because I mean, a great deal of Ulysses seems to me to be taken up with showing the large number of methods in which novels cannot be written. I suppose it's a great book. To me, it remains a little bit too static, the whole character of Bloom. I mean, there are splendid passages. I don't think it's a success as a whole.
What is the relationship of the artist to his time?
The advances in literature depend on these purely fortuitous arrival of extraordinary people. I mean, nobody could conceivably have foreseen Shakespeare. I mean, nothing preceding Shakespeare really indicated what this man would be. Nothing in Russian literature really indicated that Tolstoy would come along. I don't know. I mean, after the event, one would, by stretching the imagination a little and stretching the facts, one maybe find John the Baptist and precursors of various kinds, but are they really precursors? Do they really say anything? I don't know. I mean, I have this curious feeling that this extraordinary roulette wheel of heredity plays such a part in literature. I mean, we just sometimes you get 27 breads in a row at Monte Carlo, and this may happen at certain periods of history. You get an extraordinary series of people turning up who happen to have a fairly good environment and can do something with it. But is there really any kind of what you call a pruning period? I mean, a pruning period. I mean, I think what you can always say in the a pruning period. I mean, I think what you can always say in the history of any given art that the, so often you see that the development of an art form is due not to external circumstances at all, but is due to the internal logic of the arts. I mean, the whole process of development towards the Baroque is away from symmetry towards asymmetry, and it's exactly in the opposite direction as it is in music, as you find in music. Instead of going from asymmetry to symmetry, you go from symmetry to asymmetry. And in either case, it is the logic, the internal logic of the particular art, which dictates the development of the form, and not any external circumstances. I mean, if you look at the external circumstances in which these people live, look at a man like Schütz, for example. I mean, Schütz proceeds from sort of polyphonic through a kind of monodic to the beginnings of the sonata form. But I mean, his life consisted in continually running away from the 30 Years' War. He was in the middle of the most appalling circumstances, which you find absolutely no trace in the music at all. I mean, there's nothing catastrophic or violently emotional in the music. There is just this steady development according to the internal logic of the art. And here again, I mean, one is left wondering what on earth exactly is the relation between art and life. I don't know. I mean, it's much, much less clear than some critics maintain that it is. I mean, there's other factors. I mean, this internal logic of the art is of immense importance in the whole history of artistic development and may have very little to do with the external events. And similarly, the peculiar temperament and physique of the artist also has an enormous part to play and has, again, very little to do with the external events around him. A good many novels seem to me to have singularly little reference to it. I mean, you go find a lot of novels which are solely dealing with personal relationships in a rather narrow world. And again, you certainly find a great deal of evidence of the art forms developing not in relationship to the external world, but in relationship to their own internal logic. How do you approach general ideas? I mean, is the best way of expounding general ideas to expound them in abstract terms, which is, of course, the philosophical method, or should one try to write one's philosophy through the medium of individual case histories? This is what I have more and more tried to do. I mean, for example, in the three historical pieces I've ever written, these were essentially attempts to express general, in the widest sense, philosophical ideas in terms of particular case histories. I mean, there's this book I wrote about Father Joseph, the Grey Eminence, the book I wrote about the Devils of Loudun, and then this long essay I wrote on Maine de Biron. I would like very much to find another good sort of biographical historical episode, such as I dealt with in the Grey Eminence and The Devils of Loudun. That turned up, I mean, years and years ago I read the account in Michelet's book La Sorcière of the Loudun case, and was interested, and incidentally found when I came to look into the documents that it was extremely inaccurate. I mean, this great historian was very slapdash about the way he handled his account of the case. Well, then I thought no more about it for many years, and then quite by chance I picked up in a second-hand bookshop the 19th century reprint in a limited edition of the autobiography of the Prioress and one of Surin's autobiographical things, and the late 17th century book by Aubin on the, which is an account of the whole episode. And reading those, I was so fascinated. I mean, there was such extraordinary material there that I began collecting it, and found that in fact, I don't think any historical episode has ever had so much documentation. There are autobiographical statements by the Prioress, by Father Surin, great many letters, all the exorcisms were taken down in shorthand, great many of them are printed, and of course a vast number still remain unprinted, but probably, I never read any of the unprinted material because I just can't manage those things, but I don't think they would have contributed anything because most of the exorcisms were very like one another, so that a reasonable cross-section of them probably represented the whole fairly clearly. Then there were great many accounts by outsiders who come to look at the possessions. It became one of the sort of popular tourist resorts in 17th century Europe, and people went from all over the continent to see these nuns rolling about on the floor and screaming obscenities. It was obviously the greatest fun. These nuns, of course, were their own lunatic asylum. I mean, the whole convent was a lunatic asylum, with this screaming and with these exorcists deliberately keeping the thing up. I mean, the behavior of the exorcists, this degree of revoltingness and bad faith, which is absolutely appalling. After Grandier had been burned, they sent for the Jesuits to go, for the nuns remained just as much possessed and hysterical as ever. And as the Capuchins had failed completely in their efforts at exorcism, they called for the Jesuits, and among whom was this remarkable, very, very able man, but very unstable, psychologically unstable man, Surin, who came from Bordeaux. And he undertook not merely to dispossess the Prioress, but also to raise her to the highest pitch of mystical perfection, and in the process himself became psychologically infected and fell into a state of complete insanity in which he remained for 20 years, finally emerging, and in the last 7 or 8 years of his life becoming one of the major figures in the French 17th century mysticism. And even while he was insane, when he couldn't, I mean, he was so sort of hopelessly down that he couldn't read or write, or he could hardly even move, he was able to dictate a work on the spiritual life, which I've read. It's in 3 duodecimo volumes of about 1,200 pages, admirably well organized, with copious quotations from the Gospels and from the Fathers. This man who couldn't read or write, I mean, showing that the whole of his intellectual faculties were completely intact, while his emotional and physiological condition was absolutely disastrous. I mean, this man was completely incapable of doing anything at all, and was in fact a raving lunatic, which is, of course, one of the strangest facts about mental illness, that you can have these cases. I mean, I've seen them in contemporary life of people whose intellectual faculties are perfectly sound, and yet whose emotional life is so disturbed that they have to remain locked up in institutions for years at a stretch. It's one of the oddest paradoxes, I find. the whole business of the legal and psychological aspects of witchcraft in the 17th century, very, very interesting. I read a lot about it at the time. It's very interesting to see how, if you don't have a theory of the unconscious, you're virtually forced into the idea of possession. I mean, I think all the exorcists were convinced that this was a genuine diabolic possession. And of course they were being paid by the government. They were all getting salaries. When the publicity wore off and people got bored with it, the whole possession disappeared. I mean, the nuns were under pressure from the exorcists to go on performing. And when the money ran out, because they were being paid a subsidy by Richelieu, and they cut the subsidy off after a time, and the public opinion got bored, and they all got well. And then the extraordinary thing, the Paris then made this tour of France exactly like a movie star, because she fabricated false stigmata on her hand, which she showed. She used to sit in a window with her hand hanging out, and thousands of people would come and examine these letters which were written on the hand, supposedly by supernatural means. And she went to visit the king and queen and had this wonderful time. And then again, that was all over. It was like a sort of Marilyn Monroe procession through the country. And then, very pathetically, I mean, she became convinced that she was a sort of second St. Teresa and was going to be a great mystical saint. But of course, in fact, she wasn't. She was sort of acting the part of a great mystical saint. But in the end, she developed cancer. And a lay woman came to live in the monastery, who was a genuinely spiritual person. And it's very touching. I mean, she ended up as quite a humble, genuinely Christian figure in the end. I mean, she made a good ending in the language of the church. I mean, she really understood her own defects and this endless play-acting which she'd been doing all her life. But of course, the really strange thing about this whole story is that the whole Loudun affair is interesting only if you take the two sides together. If you take the case of Grandier and then the case of Surin, between them, the two episodes describe the religious life on every level, from the most horrible to the most sublime. I mean, the whole gamut of religious life is set forth in a kind of parabolic form in these two episodes. Now, the really extraordinary thing is that, as far as I know, I was the first person to bring these two episodes together in a single volume. Plenty of French people have written about Grandier, and in recent times, plenty of people have written about Surin. But nobody has thought fit to put the two cases together in a single volume and illustrate this fantastic spectrum of the religious life, from the most revolting to the most equivocal to the most sublime. I mean, this is the whole sort of message of this extraordinary episode, that religion is infinitely ambivalent. I mean, that it has these wonderful sides to it and these appalling sides to it. And the interesting thing to do in discussing it, of course, is to bring out both aspects. And here is a story which is strictly historical, and I really never departed from the historical documents, which is at the same time a parable. And this is what I'm looking for, is a historical or biographical medium in terms of which I can think about all sorts of general subjects and philosophical subjects, because I do strongly feel that philosophical and religious ideas are much better expressed not in abstract terms but in terms of concrete case histories, biographical or historical, and if you can find the right kind of case histories, you can find means of writing what may be called philosophy. I mean, this perhaps is a is too presumptuous a term for what I've written, but I mean it does permit the expression of general ideas in a much more powerful and penetrating way than would be possible if you were just writing about the same things in abstract terms.
Why did you come to settle down in California?
I went to California not intending to stay indefinitely. I went to, first of all, to stay with Frieda Lawrence in her ranch in New Mexico, and then went on to California to see some friends there. And I had this idea of going on to India after that, because I had a sort of vague invitation to lecture there. But then I found someone who could help me with my vision, which was rapidly going downhill at the time. And I took this sort of course in visual re-education, which helped me a great deal, and then the war broke out. Then my first wife was still alive and showed signs of TB, and we had to go and live in a very dry climate in the desert. And then then I found the climate suited me very well, and the general inertia kept me there. And I guess I find it very satisfactory. I see better in a bright climate than in a dark one, and I feel better in a warm climate than in a cold one.
You lectured a good deal in American universities.
I was lectured for every week for two semesters at the University of California at Santa Barbara, and then I lectured at Massachusetts Institute of Technology last autumn. And last spring, the spring before this, I was at for 2 months at the Menninger Foundation, at the psychiatric foundation in Topeka, which was very interesting. They have about 50 members of the staff, and I suppose about 150 young MDs and PhDs taking a 3-year course. To me, the most interesting thing was the opportunity of going around the mental hospitals. They have an enormous state hospital and a veterans hospital and Menninger's private hospital, and schools for delinquent boys and backward children and so on. One could see anything one wanted there, and it was very interesting. In the good hospitals, I mean, they attack on all the fronts at once. They give a certain amount of psychotherapy, they give chemotherapy, they give work therapy, play therapy, music therapy, and they really get to work on the person from every angle, and you have some chance of getting the person out in quite a short time if you have a decent hospital and use all these resources. Of course, and there's no doubt that the whole organic approach now is gaining ground. I mean, it's quite clear that I think that schizophrenia is essentially an organic disease, and that it has a chemical origin, and probably in time they will find chemical means of coping with it. I was talking here the other day with Dr. Sargent, who tells me that he is the chief psychotherapist at St. Thomas's, and he uses entirely organic methods and gets very good results. And you wouldn't dream of using sort of Freudian methods, so they just don't work. The person who succumbs to schizophrenia is in some way intrinsically and hereditarily vulnerable. That there is some anomaly in the metabolism and biochemistry of the person. Then this may be brought on, of course, by a psychological shock, and the shock may sort of throw him off his balance, and the biochemical anomaly then may perpetuate this thing. And the whole art of dealing with it is to try to get the biochemistry back to normal, and at the same time to give the psychological support also to teach the person to deal with his problems. I mean, if you can to a considerable extent teach the schizophrenic to cope with his these strange abnormal perceptions of the external world which he has, get him to be conscious of that these are abnormal and cope with them in a fairly rational way. But there's no doubt that we're on the threshold of very important changes in the whole treatment of mental disease. And some of these new drugs are very extraordinary. First of all, the tranquilizers have played an enormous part, and now these so-called psychic energizers are playing a huge part in getting depressed people back into a normal condition.
How often have you taken mescaline yourself?
I've taken mescaline twice and lysergic acid about five times, I suppose. I would like to take it about once a year, I think. But most people that I know who take it have no desire to sort of fool with it and take it constantly. The thing, you take it too seriously to behave in this way towards it. You wouldn't want to wallow in it. You need a good deal of time to digest this, I think. I don't know. Most people I know feel it. They don't have any special desire to go on taking it. They would like to take it every 6 months or every year or something of that kind. But I still have to meet one who wants to take it constantly.
But isn't it a condition one would want to be in all the time?
You couldn't be in it all the time because it's... It is, so to say, beyond the level of biological efficiency. The world becomes so extraordinary and so absorbing that you couldn't cross the street without considerable risk of being run over. And you wouldn't want to do anything else because just experiencing this thing is so extraordinary.
Is the effect the same on everyone?
Statistically, about 70% to 75% probably get a good and positive, happy result from it. A certain percentage get no results, and a certain percentage get very unpleasant and hell-like results out of it, get very frightened. Mine were always positive. I didn't have what some people have, which is a great elaborate visions with the eyes closed. Some people have the most elaborate and circumstantial visionary experiences. With the eyes closed, I merely see sort of living geometries, but never any of these great landscapes and figures and architectures which some people see.
Do you sit or do you move about?
You spend a lot of time sitting quietly, looking at things, and getting these sort of strange metaphysical insights into the world.
Is it a habit-forming drug?
In most cases, it has no more hangover than two cocktails, and some people feel actually much better the next day. It's being used to some extent in therapy. There's a man here called Sanderson who uses it a lot. There are several people in America. And in Canada, several groups have had very, very good results with alcoholism using LSD. And there's a new drug now, the psilocybin, which is derived from the Mexican mushroom, which is the same effect but doesn't last quite so long. And that is being used in France therapeutically with some success. When you take a capsule of 400 milligrams and the lysergic acid, you take this incredibly small dose of 100 gamma, which is 100 millionths of a gram, a 10,000th of a gram, tenth of a milligram, which is a homeopathic dose. It's perfectly extraordinary that it should have an effect. And in fact, it has an effect long after all traces of it have gone out of the body. It has an effect by triggering some, nobody knows exactly what. It probably inhibits one of the 27 enzymes which control the functioning of the brain, either inhibits one or stimulates one, and I don't think anybody quite knows what it does. But the intensity of the experience is entirely unlike any ordinary experience. But on the other hand, it quite obviously resembles spontaneous experiences certain artists and religious people have unquestionably had. it's an immense intensification of the world, the transfiguration of the external world into incredible beauty and significance. It's also beyond this kind of aesthetic experience. There may be other experiences, a sense of solidarity with the universe, solidarity with other people. Understanding of such phrases as you get in the book of Job, yea, though he slay me, yet will I trust in him. This becomes quite comprehensible. This thing opens the door to these experiences, which can be of immense value to people if they choose to make use of them, if they don't choose to. I mean, this is what the Catholics call a gratuitous grace. It doesn't guarantee salvation, or it's not sufficient and it's not necessary salvation, but if it can be collaborated with and used in an intelligent way, it can be immense help to people. The sense that in spite of everything, which of course is the ultimate, I suppose, the ultimate mystical conviction, in spite of pain, in spite of death, in spite of horror, the universe is in some mysterious sense all right, capital A, capital R.